So you're thinking about starting a new website, huh? Maybe you have a new small business idea and want to sell something online. Not porn. I tried that. Went out of business. Turns out there's a lot of competition online for porn. Who knew? Maybe you want to show off your photography, or maybe you want to start that new podcast. GoDaddy is offering an amazing deal. One new or transfer.com for just $1.99 for the first year. That's right, $1.99 for the entire year. You know what you get for $1.99? You get like 199 pieces of penny candy. They don't exist anymore, but you could get it if you had $1.99. You get my point. Anyway, each new .com comes with a free instant page website and built-in photo album. So what are you waiting for? Get your website started today. Go to GoDaddy.com and enter code Paul at checkout or click on the GoDaddy banner on our website.
Allowing it to happen.
All right, folks, this is huge. I can't believe I'm even saying this. This week, I have an interview with Sir Paul McCartney that I did in New York City. Not Paul McCartney of the Beatles. Paul McCartney, who owns a hardware store on the corner of 33rd and 10th. No, Paul McCartney, the Beatles. It was insane. I run into him in New York City, introduce myself, tell him I'm a huge fan. Couldn't have been nicer. Starts talking to me. We're talking about comedy and kids and music and touring. And we're chit-chatting, and at one point, I'm paranoid that his security is going to come over and shoot me in the leg, but nobody comes over, nobody says anything. We're talking, one thing leads to another. I ask him to do my podcast, he says, okay. I'm like, okay, well, then I'll exchange numbers with your assistant to arrange it. He goes, no, just you and I will exchange numbers, we'll figure it out. He goes, it'll be simpler. So here I am, shaking, the most surreal moment of my life, I'm writing my phone number on a piece of paper and giving it to Paul McCartney, and I hand it to him. And we talk a little bit more, and then at that point, just so you know how big I am, I cut the conversation short with Paul McCartney because I decided I didn't want to be the guy who stays too long at the party. So that's right, folks. I told Paul McCartney, hey, I can't talk to you anymore, buddy. I'm busy. I got stuff to do. So I leave, go upstairs. Go into the bathroom, lock the door, and I start hyperventilating like a 16-year-old girl. Oh, my God, I can't believe it. I just left the Paul McCartney. It was insane, right? Now, in my heart of hearts, I wanted him to call me, but I thought he never would. An hour later, my phone rings. I don't know the number. I don't recognize it. I screen the call. It goes to voicemail. It's Paul McCartney. That's right. I have a voice message from Paul McCartney saying, I'll do the podcast, an hour after I met him. And now, of course, I'm at the lowest point of my life after just being at the highest point of my life because I realized I just screened the call from Paul McCartney and he's never going to call me back. Well, I call him back, he picks up the phone, and we do the interview. And I got to tell you, the coolest guy on the planet. Really nice, really humble, no ego, interview's amazing, and, you know, just please, just listen to it, enjoy it, and... It was just a real honor. And by the way, go see him live. I just recently saw him at Fenway Park. He was amazing. The band is super tight. He sounds great. He's playing all the big hits from the Beatles albums and the Wings years. Just amazing. And enjoy the podcast, people. And if you don't enjoy this podcast, you have no soul. Check me out doing stand-up, by the way, this week in New York City. And if you want to follow me on Facebook, it's Paul Mercurio. At Paul Mercurio is my Twitter handle, and my website is paulmercurio.com.
We got the streets, suckers! Can you dig it?
Hello, Paul.
Hello, Paul McCartney.
Yes,
how are you?
I'm good, man.
Thank you so much for doing this. This is mind-blowing. And I know you're super busy, and I want to thank you, and... among a million reasons I wanted to talk to you is that I've always been fascinated by musicians. I'm a comedian and I have a creative process, and your creative process as a songwriter and such a prolific one is amazing to me. And what I've always been curious about is your evolution in terms of your persona and how you have a persona as a singular musician, but then that persona has to fit within the band persona, and how you were able to do that as a Beatle and then as part of Wings. And how does one do that as a musician?
The thing is, I think it all stems from kind of when you're growing up, you know, your formative years as a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
I liked a lot of kinds of music. When I heard rock and roll, this was kind of special. This was now music that was special to me. It was mm-hmm. my generation's music. So I kind of liked the idea of being a musician. So I got a guitar, played around at home, did mm-hmm. a couple of little things. And then I eventually, through a friend of mine, met John.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in a band already. And they asked me, about a week later, they asked me to join the band.
Mm-hmm.
So I did. And so that was kind of the start of learning how to be in a band. And so I had that experience. Mm-hmm. And then later on, we went to Hamburg, and I had the experience of being in a band under slightly more difficult circumstances, kind of, you know, we were living away from home.
Yeah.
But, you know, we were teenage guys, so we loved it, really, you know.
Did you feel the pressure in Hamburg, like you're getting paid and people coming out to see you, that there was a little bit more at stake and there was more pressure then? As you were moving along,
it wasn't so much like a pressure. It was kind of hard work. We played a lot, you know.
Yeah,
being young guys, we didn't sort of want to get into something we were sort of bored with. So we actually, you know, so we actually sort of would learn loads of songs just to stop mm-hmm. from being bored. But that all stood us in good stead when we came back to record, and the man sort of said, "Well, what do you want to do?" We said, "Well, I don't know. You take your choice from all of these." So that went on into the Beatles, and then, you know, that I learned there, and then going into Wings, I learned in that. But you're still learning. You're learning all the time. You know, you're adapting to different circumstances. But I think the secret is you got to love what you do, you know?
Was there, going from the Beatles to Wings, was there sort of maybe self-imposed pressure, kind of like Wings is sort of, you know, you were the main thrust behind that band as opposed to sharing that load. Did you feel that? How did you deal with that, if you felt that?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I think with the Beatles, it was a band of equals.
Right.
And that was a great thing, but it sometimes created difficulties, which wasn't a bad thing, as I say, because you'd work through the difficulties and you'd come out with something good the other end. So, you know, having your work questioned was not necessarily a bad thing. But by the time I was in Wings, I'd kind of put all the work in with the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt now I could actually lead the band.
Right.
So that was a different thing. You know, it meant I could call the shots a lot easier. Even though in the Beatles, whoever wrote the song could call the shots.
It was more democratic with the Beatles, right? I know that one person could vote down a song and it wouldn't make... Explain that to people. I'm fascinated by that.
Yeah, that's right. You know, it was different completely because now I was a leader of the band.
Yeah.
And so, but I had to learn that persona too, you know, and try and be kind of inclusive of the band members.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, try and think what our audience was going to want to hear.
Mm-hmm.
So we mixed and matched it, you know, and eventually around about 76 when we made the album Wings Over America, by that point, you know, we kind of had it together. So we made it work, you know, that was a great thing.
Your writing process, one of the things you talked about is early on you would write to the audience, for the audience, and then you reach the point where you stop doing that and writing for yourself. And it's very parallel in a lot of ways to comedy, where you'll initially write material, I think, when you're starting out that's going to please the crowd, and then you start to want to write from a more personal place. A lot of great comedians mm-hmm. have done that, Richard Pryor and Lenny Bruce.
Robert Williams.
Yeah, absolutely. Talk about that a little bit. Like, when did you make that turn? Is it a matter of getting enough self-confidence to go, you know what, I'm going to do this more for me and what I want to say as opposed to what I think people want to hear? And when did that turn?
Yeah, you know, I think the thing is, with everything we did and still with stuff I do now, there's never really a conscious decision to do this or that. Mm-hmm. I mean, the whole thing is, I'm just going to do it and see how it comes out. And I think as you develop, you know, at first you think, okay, I'm just going to do it now. People are going to hear these songs, so this better be something that relates to the audience. And, you know, you worry more about that at the beginning. Mm-hmm. As you say, once you go on a bit, you think, well, I've kind of been there, done that. And now right. I've sort of got that out of my system. And maybe these people I'm writing for mm-hmm. will be willing to accept something that's a little bit out of left field. Let's see. And so you try it. You know, you try a song, and you then don't worry about it being quite sort of within the same parameters as it used to be. So you try it, and then you play it for someone, and they sort of say, whoa, man, that's, you know, you're really moving forward. And then you make the record, and so it kind of happens naturally. There's a natural development. We never wanted to be bored. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Beatles were just young guys who just did not. The worst thing would be we sit around and we're really bored, because we would have then had to consider whether we wanted to do this or not. So the whole trick was always trying to not bore yourself or your audience or each other. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what brought about the natural development. You were always wanting to show people the new trick.
Yeah, and you talk about you would say to Ringo or something, did you play that riff or that snare on the last track? If you did, couldn't do it. Like track to track, you would demanding of yourselves that you'd be different. Isn't that right?
Yeah, you know, I mean, we thought that we made one record, and then it was like, okay, now completely clean canvas.
Yeah.
You're not gonna now just go, okay, how was our last record? Let's slavishly copy it, change a few words, change the riff, and that'll do. You know, we weren't interested in that. And it was funny because we were seeing people who were doing that. Mm-hmm. There were some artists who their next record would be like their last record. And we just thought, oh, man, they've wasted such an opportunity there. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a blank canvas. So we always wanted to make a new mark on each and every canvas we got a chance to operate on. No, that's what happened.
And, you know, this is why I think you and the band were both brilliant and brave, because as a performer myself, you do want to, you kind of get your stuff that does well. You know, you get those jokes that you know do well, and you just keep going to that well. And you're on a world stage, and the entire world is following you and in love with you. And to have the guts to go, you know what, I know you like, you know, Hard Day's Night, but we're going Sgt. Pepper. Come with us or don't come with us. Obviously, brilliant musicians and songwriters, but fundamentally as a person in being Paul McCartney, where does that confidence come from?
Well, you know, I would say that the Beatles was a unit. And we were a unit that we'd worked together a lot. We lived in and out of each other's pockets. I mean, once when it was really cold and the window blew out on the van, we actually like lay on top of each other in a Beatles sandwich. By that point you're getting pretty intimate. You're knowing each other. So I think we gave each other the confidence, and as each little new canvas was painted, mm-hmm. we go, mm-hmm. oh man, that's cool. Okay, now let's do something different. So it was a natural evolution, and by the time we got fed up of touring because we couldn't really hear ourselves, it was all that was getting a bit boring, you know,
right.
at that point, because we'd worked very hard. You know, we'd work sort of over 300 days out of a year, you know, we would work.
Right.
So just the toll of the sheer physical working led us to have this idea. We thought, well, let's just let's just make a record. Let's just stop touring, go into the studio, and we'll make a record. And we'll say, well, let the record go on tour.
Mm-hmm.
And so did you feel whole new concept, you know?
And when you were doing that, though, did you feel like you were losing, by not being able to tour, that you were losing touch in some way with your audience?
No, we didn't. I mean, we, at that point, this wasn't us being worried about our audience. This was four artists in full flow. So it was more a question of, look, the philosophy by then was, if we like it, they're going to like it.
Right.
And we had that confidence. So we just hit upon this whole sort of idea of Sgt. Pepper's, the Oscar band, the new personas. We'll have fictitious personas. We hit upon this crazy idea. And so we just went into the studio, and we were in there on and off over a period of about 6 months. And people outside, you know, the newspapers and the musical press were starting to say, oh, they've dried up, they haven't got any ideas. But we were sitting in the studio tinkering away like the Seven Dwarfs.
Right.
And we were tinkering away with this new stuff we were making. And we were kind of giggling, you know, when we hear they've dried up, we go, oh, no, we haven't. Wait till you hear what we're working on, you know. So it was a natural progression, and we kind of felt that what we were doing was cool, and it turned out that we lost some of the audience, but then we thought, well, we gained even more. So it was a cool thing.
How was recording with George Martin to your writing process, and did that evolve over time, or was he initially from the get-go a very involved fifth Beatle, if you will, which I've heard him referred to. Sorry about the PA system at the Daily Show here, but go ahead, and if you can tell me about George Martin. I'm fascinated by that relationship.
No problem, man. The thing was, George wasn't really a help in the writing. That would be me, John, and later George. We would do that separate from George. But when we bring it in, the production and the making of the record, he was really then a great part. So that's where the fifth Beatle kind of comes in.
For a novice like myself, what is the producer's function at that point, and what value add? I mean, obviously the value added in the writing, in the process of making the music. What does...
Well, there are loads of little things that, you know, you talk about dotting the I's and crossing the T's. Sometimes you don't want to cross all the T's and dot the I's. You figure you put enough in. So there would be things like that we knew we could leave with George, and we could set him tasks, you know.
Ah.
I remember saying, you know, we'd say, look, we love Bach, but well, we don't know how to play like Bach. You're a bit of a pianist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, go home and write a solo for this song that is, that will fit the song, but that is completely in Bach's style. So George Martin would do that. We could set him those tasks. And then overall, as an overseer and the sound and the engineers, he was really good. He was good for that. You knew you had someone who was actually flying the plane.
Yeah.
So we could goofball around as much as we liked. But it's like your work. It's kind of good to have a producer of the show.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he helps. He puts it all together. And if you go home, he won't.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, listen, Paul.
Thank you, sir.
Meeting you, man. And
same
it was
here.
Fun doing a Colbert show. Yes. And so hi to all your listeners and all your folks who are digging this. And good luck to you, man. You take it easy.
Thank you, sir. You're the best. And good luck with your daughter. Enjoy her while she's young and goes by fast. You're the best. And thank you so much for doing this. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
Thanks so much, man. See you. Bye-bye.
You take over one borough at a time. Secure our territory. Secure our turf.
Because it's all.